Good evening and welcome to this lecture by John Bradshaw. Tonight, John's topic is The Core of Spirituality, Healthy Shame and Modesty. Now to our program, which is just getting underway.
Thank you. Thank you, folks. Hey. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Somehow being Irish, Scotch-Irish, Catholic, I feel like I belong here in Boston. It's like I'm coming home. There's something really wonderful about this city and all of you, and I'm really happy to be here. And I come with some sense of trepidation because I don't lecture on spirituality a lot, although I consider everything that I'm involved in to be about spirituality. And there's a lot of paradox in my life, and I wrote about that in the book Creating Love, in the chapter on the love of God. I wrote about how when I left the seminary, I was studying to be a priest, I left the seminary what was called the novitiate year. And during that year, we lived pretty much a monastic life. We lived celibate, and we took a vow of poverty, and we took a vow of obedience to the superior. And I was a very rigid seminarian. I mean, I was rigid like I was a rigid alcoholic. I had that sort of sense of whatever I was going to do, I was going to do it almost without limit. So I used to kneel for 5 hours sometimes and not move a muscle. And I had occasion during that year to make the 9 First Fridays. If any of you are Catholic, you'll know about this. Now, I'd always tried in high school to make the 9 First Fridays, but I never could make them. Because I was a very sexually vibrant young adolescent. And masturbation was one of the things you couldn't do and still be in the state of grace. So even at the risk of going blind, I did not make the 9 First Fridays. It bothered me that I didn't, because it was kind of at least I don't want to put it down. I mean, I'm glad I made them. But I had a wonderful old Irish Catholic nun named Sister Rogata who used to just absolutely terrify us with stories about living a perfect life and living perfectly in virtue in one second before you die, committing one mortal sin and going straight to hell. And I thought, oh my God, you know, and like, so the 9 First Fridays were like a gut cinch. You know, it's like it gives you the grace to repent. So I was glad to have that insurance. And so when I took my first vows, also some Catholic theologians believe that you are restored to absolute purity, like you were at the moment of baptism. So when my mother and my aunt and uncle came to get me in Rochester, New York, to drive to Toronto, I had this secret hope. I'm 21 years old. I had this secret hope that we would die, because I would get to go straight to heaven. Now, I didn't share this with them, especially during my part of the driving. But I was ready to die. I'm 21 years old. I'm ready to die. Now, I'm telling you this because my life has unfolded a lot, and a lot has changed in my life. Although, as I stand here tonight, I think of myself, I don't talk about this a lot, as a reformed priest. That is, I'm doing now what I set out to do. But I'm doing it in a way I never could have anticipated. and I'm not doing it as a celibate person, which I'm very grateful for. Although I hope God remembers those 10 years. I want those chalked up for me. I'm going to check on that the first thing I do when I hit the Golden Gate. I want to know if you got those 10 years. But what I wrote about in Creating Love is that I think that some of what I believed at that time is really a mystified belief. And what I mean by mystification, I wrote a lot about in that book, is a sense of confusion, where I was confusing God, as I understood God, with my parents, with my patriarchal upbringing, and that I really hadn't left home yet. I was just continuing the same drama at home that I'd had at home in the church. And I had married Holy Mother just as I had been bonded to my mother, because my father was an alcoholic and had left the family. And in a sense, my commitment never to marry was a way never to leave my mother. Now, I'm not saying that about any other priest or any other religious person. I'm only saying that about myself. That as I look back on it now, that religion that I was in, my religion, I don't mean the Catholic religion, my religion was a kind of religiosity. See, I believe that religion should be a container for spirituality. That is, it should be the soil out of which spirituality grows. And when that doesn't happen, religion becomes religiosity. Religion becomes a closed system. It becomes rigid. It becomes something that destroys freedom. And we're seeing a lot in our treatment center, for example, we're seeing a lot of religious addiction, and how the high in religious addiction, I would like to examine the brain of a person in a moment of righteousness. And I bet you those endorphins would look the same as a person who's high on cocaine, because it's a tremendous high to feel righteous. I mean, I can remember kneeling in the chapel, feeling the pain in my knees, but also being very aware of the brothers who weren't there, kind of keeping score. And it became a kind of spiritual athletic contest. Who could fast the most, and who could pray the longest, and who could kneel the straightest, and who could take the longest to make the Stations of the Cross. And so, for me, there's been a great transformation of what I've come to understand as spirituality. And I want to share that with you tonight, but it's hard to talk about it. What I learned in writing this book on Creating Love is that love is something you can't talk about completely. You know, the poet says, our whitest pearl we never find, our ripest fruit we never reach, the flowering moments of the mind drop half their petals in our speech. That the most profound things in our life, which I think are spiritual things, cannot be fully expressed in words. We can describe it. We can know it's there. I mean, we know that love motivates human life. We know about love intuitively. That's another thing that I was trying to say in the new book, is that it's, be careful about St. Teresa of Avila or Albert Schweitzer's. I mean, they're wonderful, good people. But it may be the mailman. It may be the guy that you work with. Maybe the gal that you know that is struggling, who may be what Graham Greene calls a saint without name. Somebody who doesn't look like a saint, doesn't have all the credentials of a saint, doesn't have all that incredible, you know, model of a saint, but somebody who's struggling and who is committed and who keeps trying and he keeps going back and working on it. And that if we set our sights too high, we may miss the love that's around us. And I think we have to be careful about defining love. The approach that I think we have to take to it as phenomenological. That is, you can describe it like a phenomenon. You can say it's this. You can say it's that. It's like looking at the earth from outer space. You can only see one side of it or an aspect of it. And you can describe that, but you can't describe it all. So whatever it is that men and women have called spiritual from the beginning of time, it has always been about something like love, like truth, like goodness, like being itself, like God, the ultimate, the ground of being, like beauty, that we know is there, but it's not something that we can capture in words. It's not something that we can describe, that we can define. We can describe it. We can talk about it. We can talk about our experience of it. And really, that's all we can really talk about, is our experience of it. So the spiritual, as I use it tonight, will be that which is not material. It will be that which is not, of course, even when I say that, I mean, our physicists are telling us that matter can be broken down into atoms and molecules and atoms and neutrinos, and it can get into such infinitesimal parts that we can't even measure them, because when we try to measure them, our instruments of measure knock them away. And there's some kind of inner radiance in matter that goes all the way back to that hydrogen atom. Some kind of inner radiance, some kind of intelligibility that's in the evolution of the universe, of nature. So that we're now beginning to understand that we need every whale and every dolphin and every leaf and every bird and every species and every color of person and every type of person. And that the diversity, the difference, is what we really need. It's not the problem, it's the solution of how we're going to live together and how we're going to be together and how we're going to honor each other. So even when I say it's not material, I have some second questions about that, because we're beginning to ask ourselves now, you know, is consciousness, matter is energy and consciousness is energy. But whatever it is, it's something that is often paradoxical. That is, it is seemingly contradictory. I mean, we're a people that have come out of Judeo-Christianity, a God who is in flesh, is part of the core of Christianity, a resurrection that can only come out of crucifixion. A joy that can only come out of sorrow. See, that's paradoxical. And so whatever else spirituality is, it's paradoxical. It's something that I would have never thought of myself standing on this stage tonight saying I'm a Reformed priest. That isn't what I set out to do at 21. But yet what I'm doing now is what I set out to do, but not in the way that I'm doing it. So if that makes any sense to you, and that there's so many things in my life that are like that. We just passed 3.5 million books since 1988 sold. I never even thought I'd write a book. I had no, it wasn't part of my 10-year plan. It wasn't part of my 5-year plan. It wasn't part of any plan I ever had. I mean, it amazes me. But it seems like that this is what life is about, and it's what human life is about. People amaze me. People that I thought I knew so well. You know, suddenly one day you see them in another light, and it just blows me away. Oh, I'd have never expected that of old Sidney, or old Myrtle, or old whoever. Isn't that amazing? So paradox is the heart of human life. And one of the reasons for that is that we are paradoxical beings. We are the beings who are not gods, and yet we continually try to transcend ourselves. We're the incomplete beings who seek completion. We're the uncertain beings who want certainty and will go to great lengths to try to grasp certainty. We'll basically give up our lives sometimes for certainty. We'll form false selves in order to get out of our confusion and the ambiguity of being human. We'll form false selves for the certainty of being loved by someone. We're hurting and we want wholeness. We are the beings who can juxtapose. We laugh. We're the only animals who really can laugh. Laughing hyenas don't get the jokes. I mean, they're laughing, but I mean, our laughter is because we can juxtapose the incongruous. We can put two things together and see the humor in it. We're the only animals who weep. We're the only animals who cry with tears. And we're now beginning to discover that those tears have hormones in them that actually normalize brain chemistry, and that we need to cry. What all my work is about is delayed grief. We'll be here this weekend helping people go through the developmental stages so that they can grieve those things that they never grieved. Because delayed grief, we now understand, is the basis for what has come to be called post-traumatic stress disorder. I saw one wonderful TV documentary last night about these medical people in New York who are out every day picking up half-dead people and how they just live in post-traumatic stress disorder, and how they've begun to get together and debrief. And the guy that they were interviewing, I mean, I thought, my God, if ever there was a hero, it's this man who goes unseen day in and day out, driving those ambulances, picking up people who are half-dead or blown away or bleeding. And they were talking about the toll that this takes on him and these men, and how they've been suicides among these people. And these are all the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. This is what we've also learned about our childhood. When we can't grieve the hurts of our childhood, we develop symptoms. And we develop whole meetings all over the country called adult-child meetings and codependency meetings about these symptoms, which are basically the symptoms of delayed grief. We know now, unequivocally, that we were supposed to cry, that we have these tear ducts in order to finish things, that grief is the healing feeling, that blessed are they that mourn, that mourning is important to us. Now, we've come out of hundreds of years of patriarchy and a kind of a system that was built out of the vulnerability and the treacherousness of human life, so that people lived in very defensive ways, and that's why you needed patriarchs and kings to protect you, and life was about survival. And so these issues didn't come up. These issues can only come up when you're in the fruits of democracy, when you have freedom, where we have enough time and enough freedom to look at these kind of issues, and enough just basic safety to be able to look at these kind of issues. That's why these issues have all come up in the last 100 years. Because human life has progressed, and there is much more just basic, raw safety in terms of what it was hundreds of years ago. We're the only animals who weep. We're the only animals who laugh. And we're the only animals who have shame. Now, a puppy might be bashful, you know, a puppy might be coyed, an animal might be coyed out of fear, but shame is a natural, innate human emotion. And I'm going to suggest tonight that natural shame is the source of spirituality. And that's very strange to people when they first hear that. For somebody to say that shame is the source of spirituality, and that shame safeguards the spirit. And I'm going to tell you that I learned that not from all those years of theology and philosophy. I did not learn that getting my degree in philosophy or my degrees in theology. I learned that paradoxically walking into a smoke-filled room of recovering drunks. It's when I learned about this. And that's probably the greatest paradox of my life. That the great spiritual awakening I had came out of sitting in rooms with recovering drunks, sharing, telling our stories, telling about our pain, being vulnerable with each other, building a community out of that vulnerability, accepting our limitations, accepting our powerlessness, which is what I believe every human being needs to do, is to accept limitations, and that's what healthy shame is the acceptance of limitations. Be careful of people who tell you that we humans have unlimited powers. That is serious and dangerous to tell human beings that. We do not have unlimited power. We are limited. We are limited by our feet. We are limited by our instinctual life. We're limited in that we have to eat. We have to sleep. We're going to die. We're finite. We're limited. And when you don't rest your life in the core of that paradox, that I'm limited and a lot of my life is necessitated, and yet at the same time I am free and I want to transcend, or I want to be what Nietzsche said, man is ubermensch. We're always trying to overcome, over man, over ourselves. We're trying to transcend ourselves. Our spirituality is the part of us that is always trying to transcend itself. So we're this incredibly paradoxical, we are these incredibly paradoxical beings who stand in the middle of time with necessity on the one hand and freedom on the other hand. And that as we've climbed the ladder in the evolution of life, we have moved more and more away from instinctual determinism and moved toward freedom. And there is an ever-evolving kind of freedom in human life, in human consciousness. So that if we are going to ground our life in reality, I have to ground my life in the paradox that I am. That I am on the one hand less than God, but striving and in many ways wanting to be God, as Jean-Paul Sartre has shown us very well, a man who was not a believer, who saw that propensity in people to make their reality ultimate reality, to make themselves the norm of reality. There's that propensity in us to play God. And I learned that in those 12-step meetings too. That you got to rejoin the human race, they said. You got to quit playing God. You got to stop your grandiosity. See, after all those years of knowing all the theologians and the philosophers and discussing and reading the Summa Theologiae and the Summa Contra Gentiles of Thomas Aquinas and reading the Calvin and Luther and the great reformers and Martin Buber and Moses Maimonides and all these great minds, I'm learning about spirituality in a room full of recovering alcoholics. I mean, that's paradoxical. That's paradoxical any way you cut it. And I not only learned about spirituality, I got it because I had studied those desert fathers. I'd read those desert fathers in Latin. I hope God remembers that too. I had studied those traditions of monastic spirituality. I had studied tremendous amounts. And I began to realize that this phenomena that began in 1934 of one alcoholic turning to another, of 12 steps that end with having had a spiritual awakening, was restoring a tradition of spirituality that had been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. What Ernst Kurtz calls the spirituality of imperfection. The spirituality that is rooted in imperfection, in getting it that the greatest error that any human will ever make is trying to be perfect. And there's a great kind of misnomer that's come out of people's reading of the New Testament. There's a word there, and it's a word that sent me to the monastery. Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And the word really means whole. It means complete. It doesn't mean perfect in the sense that I thought it meant. Because what I thought it meant was to be polarized on the side of righteousness, at least what I was taught was righteousness, which meant that you never have any ambition, you never have any desire for, you know, your own glorification, you never have any desire for strokes, that you're self-effacing, that you're always into duty and obligation and responsibility, and that freedom is simply obeying the rules. That's what I grew up with. And I became polarized in the side of me that had all of that, but wouldn't let myself have anger. I wouldn't let myself have that normal desire for self-enhancement and the joy that goes with it, and the self-enhancement that can come out of love, and the celebration of your own victories and achievements, and the finding of your own bliss. I couldn't let myself have any of that. See, because what healthy shame really tells us, and we have this innately, it comes out in blushing. Sylvan Tompkins and his colleagues did research, cross-cultural studies. They found that there was not a species of people, not a kind of people anywhere in the world who didn't blush, who didn't have that innate sense of limits, that I've made a mistake. See, so healthy shame is the emotion that signals that I made a mistake. And it's very interesting to me when I look at the 12 steps, that the 10th step says we continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. That it's really about people who can't make mistakes and are so obsessed on not guarding lest anybody would ever see me vulnerable or ever see me make a mistake. So I guard lest I'm ever unguarded. See, so that step's really saying, hey, lighten up. Lighten up, man. That enlightenment is lightening up. That no human beings are going to live. In fact, we are error prone. Don't we know that? Look at we are a nation of sports. We love sports. Who's the greatest quarterback that ever lived? Well, I don't know, but Montana, 62% completion rate. What does that mean? It means he missed 38% of the time. So 38% of the time he was failing. Babe Ruth struck out more than he ever hit home runs. Two out of three times. One out of three, you win the batting title. That means you missed twice. Two times you fail to every one time you succeed. I mean, sports have it. Error is part of the game. We know it's there. We accept it's there. We think nothing of it. We don't expect Larry Bird to hit it every time. We know he's going to miss sometimes. That's part of the game. Now, isn't that interesting? That we've come to our own lives and expect that we'll never make a mistake. That we're going to get it right all the time, we're going to do everything perfect, and that we have to live in hiding, never showing anybody our vulnerability or our so-called vulnerability. See, what healthy shame allows you to accept is your vulnerability. It says it is part of being human to be vulnerable. See, this was Buddha's first noble truth. I mean, I'm sitting in a 12-step meeting one night, and I thought, my God, here's a bunch of drunks down on Dowling in Houston enunciating Buddha's first noble truth. This is really weird. What were they enunciating? Buddha said, if you're in human form, you're going to suffer. Why? Because to be in human form is to be limited in perception. When I'm looking over here, I'm ignoring the people over here. I mean, if you notice, I'm making a real conscious effort to come over and make some contact with you all and then get over here and so that I can not play favorites. I probably am weighted toward the left side a little bit, but I'm trying not to play favorites. I'm trying to make contact with all of you, but you see, as a human being, my head can't go around. My head can't go around. So when I'm looking over here, I'm ignoring the people over there. So Buddha said we have ignorance. That to be human is to have ignorance. That part of being human is to have ignorance. Mark is giving me signals about the time. I don't want you to think this is a dysfunctional family. See, in my family, that would have been normal. Like somebody had come out and gone, whoop, and no one would have said anything. I don't know whether you can identify with that, but people were making weird signs and nobody was talking about it. So we have this ignorance. So you got three kids and you love them all, and you're over here giving strokes to one of them, the other two feel abandoned. And you're a single mom and you work your butt off all day and you're tired. So you're not going to get this perfect. Nobody is. No one's ever going to get this perfect. And when we set ourselves up to try to get it perfect, we are setting ourselves up for failure. You can't get it perfect. It's human. And to be human is to be error-prone. To be human is to be incomplete. To be human is to be longing. To be human is to make mistakes. And because of this paradoxical vulnerability that we have as human beings, we need help. So the most important human sound is a cry. Is a cry. I mean, go read the psalmist. They cry out to God on the hills. They're crying out of their pain, of their loneliness. They're saying we need help. So the human condition is a condition in which we need help. And it's that very need for help and our very vulnerability which allows us to form community. It allows us to form community. So what does healthy shame teach us? That we're limited, that we're in need of help, that we will make mistakes, that part of our nature is ignorance. So we're going to blush. We're going to be embarrassed at times. We're going to be caught with our pants down. You know, I walked out with my fly open the other day. You know, I walked right out into the lobby of the hotel. Fly open. Very embarrassing. Especially when you're pontificating to somebody, you know. With your fly open? Acting very sophisticated, you know. Or just when you get too high and mighty, you have to go to the bathroom. See, that's being human. And I'm telling you, folks, we live in a society, in a culture that over years has begun to have unrealistic expectations. We have unrealistic expectations of our children. We have unrealistic expectations of our parents. We have unrealistic expectations of our lovers, of our spouses, of our friends. Unrealistic. What Martin Buber called fantastic imagination. Not an imagination that's based on reality. Because when you can't have your healthy shame, now, I'm going to talk in the second hour of how to foster that. How do we foster that healthy shame in our life? See, because healthy shame is going to lead to healthy guilt, which is moral shame, which means that I'm not going to be shameless in my life. I'm going to know that there's good guy John here and John out here, you know, working to make it a better planet, but John over here that wants to murder some people. I mean, not right now, but have you ever wanted to murder somebody? Like your spouse? Oh God, you know, now watch out with your righteousness. Oh no, not me, you know, watch out, because that's your dark side. That side that wants to murder somebody. That side when you're married thinks of how it would be with this other person over here. Oh, you don't tell the spouse this. Or even the side that fantasizes that spouse being dead.
Oh, we're not going to talk about that. Right? No, we're not going to talk about that.
That happens.
And you know, we don't have to entertain it. We don't have to give it fuel. But it's human. It's human to look at somebody else's ass. It's human. And when we pretend like, well, I don't do that. Well, maybe you don't. But you're missing out on some stuff. That's what's happening. And you're going to die and have missed out on some good asses in your life. And women do it too. That amazed me. I thought only guys did. I didn't even think women went to the bathroom for a long time. So this healthy shame also, see, Nietzsche, it was the German philosopher Nietzsche that said, shame safeguards the spirit. Shame is the source of spirituality. Now, one interesting thing, we only have one word for shame in English. In German, there are two words. There's the word Scham and Schande. French has two words. Latin has two words. Greek has more than two words. And in other languages, the word for natural shame really comes close to being humility. It means discretion. It means modesty. See, natural shame is modesty, or a sense, a need for privacy. See, we've got problems with that in the modern world. I mean, you lay down in a hotel and turn on television, somebody's doing oral sex. And that's a private thing. That's private. I mean, I don't want to see anybody else doing that. I mean, there's something shameless about that. I'm not a prude, but there's something shameless about that. People don't have any boundaries. They don't have any sexual boundaries. Because that's a kind of act that you do privately. Like birth, for the ancients, birth was private, death was private. Because there's such profound mysteries. Your friendships were private. Life cycle events were private. Your sex life was private. Your body was private. See, that's healthy shame, a sense of modesty. And all languages have that. Now, also languages, the sense that Nietzsche uses the word... Oh, let me give you Aristotle. I ran across this text of Aristotle. He said, when lovers gaze at each other, they do not look at their bodily parts. They stare at each other's face. It is there that they experience shame. But what he means by shame is awe, a sense of the holy. That's the way Homer used it. When Homer uses the word shame, in one context, it's awe in the face of the gods. And that's the sense Nietzsche is using it. That shame safeguards the spirit. When you truly have a sense of shame, you know you're limited. You know the paradoxical quality of human life, how we're this mixture between necessity and freedom. We're spiritual, but we're animal. And we know we're not God. See, when you have a healthy sense of shame, you know you're not God. You know there's something greater than yourself. You know your limits. So healthy shame, Max Scheler, the German philosopher, said, see what I'm quoting, I'm not trying to impress you with these quotes. I'm trying to give you that there's a vast tradition of spirituality that we've lost touch with. And the thing that brought it back to me in my life was the 12-step program. The founders, Bill W. and Dr. Bob. One of the great things that's happened in this century has been the emergence of Alcoholics Anonymous and all the 12-step groups, because they have brought back a kind of basic spirituality that is rooted in knowing your powerlessness and imperfection and knowing that we need help. Knowing that we need help and that there's something greater than ourselves. That's what the 12 steps say. We believe that something greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We made a decision to turn our will and lives over the care of God as we understand God. Now, it's not religion. It's not dogma. Bill W. hated dogma. I hate dogma. The thing I don't like about religions is that each one says we're saved and you're not. At some level, they say that. And by the way, religion is supposed to be a private thing. I think. You know, and Jesus says, when you pray, go in the room and shut the door. I mean, think about these garish TV evangelists out there contorting their faces for the whole television world, praying in front of everybody. Now, I say this in all charity. But I think this stuff is shameless. It's shameless. I've thought, this is outrageous. What is outrageous about it? It's shameless. It's taking something deeply private. See, spiritual is not about the outer life. It's about the inner life. Now, paradoxically, the reason that room full of alcoholics seemed to be, for me, the vehicle, because my alcoholism was a perverted spirituality. I believe that addicts are trying to seek ecstasy and transcendence and don't know how to get there and get caught on the roads of their addictions. And their addictions, we have 131 million addicts in this country. That's a metaphor of the spiritual bankruptcy. And the day I heard them define alcoholism as spiritual bankruptcy and addiction as spiritual bankruptcy, boy, did that grab my attention. And you know, if you're a clinician, if you're a behavior modifier, if you're a person who doesn't believe in the unseen, you've got to explain the phenomena of Alcoholics Anonymous. You've got to explain that. You've got to look at that with the eyes of a scientist. That here are people who say we turned our will and lives over to something greater, who pray, who say we sought through prayer and meditation, who make a list of all the people they've harmed and make amends and come together in these meetings and tell their stories and listen and learn to listen and build community. See, I haven't had a drink in 27 years and 2 months. That's a long time between drinks. Okay? And I don't ever want to think, I don't ever want to not be grateful to the source that got me here, the 12-step community. But I don't think about alcohol anymore, and I don't call myself, except in the context where I think it's useful, an alcoholic. I'm much more than a recovering alcoholic. I call myself a codependent for 10 years. That was great. The second I saw those traits of codependency, I knew I wasn't just weird and crazy. I mean, here were all these other people who had it. That's what that did for me. So thank God for the word codependence. It gave me a home. It was a sense of belonging to be an alcoholic. It was a sense of belonging to be a codependent. I never felt at home anywhere. I was Heimlich. Franz Kafka says it. My life was unhomelike. I never felt at home. I never felt at home in my body. I never felt at home anywhere in my life. I was, as G.K. Chesterton says, homesick at home. So when I walked in that 12-step meeting and all those guys and gals started telling their stories, I said, my God, they've been following me around. I belong somewhere. Not as an intellectual at Rice Institute teaching the psychology of religion, because I could really do that number. But I never felt like I belonged. I never felt camaraderie with my fellow professors. Now, that was more about me than about them. But when I heard those stories, I could belong. And when I heard people talk about being in dysfunctional families, I could belong. I could identify. Now, I want to give up those terms. You know, I don't want to spend the rest of my life saying I'm an addict codependent. I'm much more than that, and you're much more than that, and we're much more than any label we could ever get. We're much more than that. As useful as those labels are, there's a point where they're worth moving on and expanding, because my being can never be contained in an adjectival modifier. I'm more than that. There's a depth to the human heart that nobody understands. Don't believe anybody that tells you they do. There's a mystery to each human person. There's a deep mystery to each human person. There's a sense in which nobody knows me. And I bet you can say that too. I got some best friends that are close with me. I've got a sweetheart. My former wife and I are great friends, and she knows a lot about me, and my children know about me. My children probably know me better than anybody. They know me at a kind of gut level, but there's still a place that nobody knows me. There's a place where nobody can capture me in concepts or in their experience. And all of us have that. And there's a uniqueness about and an unrepeatability about all of us that'll never be again. So that's a sense of mystery that means, you know, what the American Indians understood, that everything is full of soul, that there's music in all things, Shelley says, if men had ears, that there's a depth to everything, there's a fuller sense to everything than our concepts can imagine. Robert Bly, Marion Woodman talk about the materialization of consciousness, how we've literalized things, and we miss symbol and analogy, and we miss myth, and we miss the symbolic level of things, that things are always more than anything we can say. Now, healthy shame, humility, sense of discretion, a sense of awe in the face of being. See, we're the animals who ask the question of being, but since we are beings in being, we can never get out of being in order to understand the answer completely. That's another part of our paradox. So we have existential anxiety, which is that we have anxiety just because we can't fully know the ground of being because we're in it, asking the question. But we can't get out of it, because if you get out of it, you're no longer being. And if you get out of it, then you can't get the answer to the question. But we are the ones who ask the question, why is there something rather than nothing? What is the being of the things that are? The great philosophers hundreds of years ago began to ask. All knowledge begins in wonder, Aristotle said. So this curiosity, which is part of our natural endowment, is part of our spiritual quest. We are the animals who wonder and seek and want answers and want to break the atom and want to create. And that creativity may be the most profound sense of our spirituality. See, I've often thought, if we're made in the image of God, whoever else God is, she's a creator. A creator. I believe in God, the creator. The creator of heaven and earth. A creator. All religions, all holy writ, talk about God as the creator. We want to be like God, then let's be creators. Not passive pawns on the scoreboard of life. Not conformists who never have an idea of our own. Sitting there listening to some guru tell us how to think and how to feel. And some guru interpreting scripture and not copping out that that's his own subjective interpretation. That even the Holy Roman Catholic Church has only defined 7 scriptures as De Fide Divina et Catholica. So there, that's the Holy Roman Catholic Church has only dared say what 7 scriptures mean. So here's some guy running around with a Bible telling everybody what the truth is. And shaming everybody who believes him because you don't measure up. See, shame is always about, do I measure up? And once you have absolutes, once you have measures, you have the possibility of shame because you're going to measure yourself by those measures. And I'm going to talk about that in the second hour, how this healthy sense of shame can be fostered with each other in our life. How do we create environments where our children can develop a healthy sense of shame? Because if shame is the core of spirituality, and I'm going to say more, shame comes close to defining what it is to be human. That's what Max Scheler said. Shame comes close to being the very essence of what is human. Because shame is that emotion, that blush, that embarrassment, that shyness in the face of strangers that lets us know we're not God. That we're limited, that we're finite. Shame is also the very emotion that motivates us to learn and to create. See, you can't create if you know it all. There's an old Sufi story about a professor that comes over and the guy's giving him tea and he's pouring the tea and he just keeps pouring it and it's overflowing. And the guy says, what are you doing this for? What are you doing? You're spilling the tea. And he answers, well, your cup is already full. There's nothing you could learn from me. It's pretty clear from your demeanor that you think you know it all. So what could I teach you? See, it's not until I'm empty that I can be filled. Confusion is one of the very best prerequisites for creativity. Confusion means I don't know. I need to think. I need to brainstorm. We don't know. Let's get together and brainstorm because none of us know. So we're going to come up with something because we don't know the answer. If you already know the answer, you're in trouble. There's an old story about, forget what they call them, but one of the holy men in the Muslim tradition where they ask, well, if you go to that teacher, how will you know that they really are one of the really holy men, teachers? And the answer is, if they give you advice, you'll know they're not. That's all. You'll know they're not when they give you advice, because spirituality is about seeking. It's about questions. It's not about having all the answers. Jacques Maritain, a great French philosopher, said, I'm 87 now, and I think I'm beginning to understand the questions. But in philosophy, in theology, the issue is, what are the questions? See, and the ultimate questions are what spirituality is about. Now, when you don't get to develop that healthy sense of shame, that permission to be human, then what do you develop? You develop a toxic sense of shame. And so here's what you do with toxic shame. You either just give in to it, because toxic shame, and I'll talk about this after we take a break, is to be over-limited and overseen. See, as a child, I was overseen. Can you identify with that? There was somebody always watching me. You couldn't get away from their eyes. See, 15 years later, I sat in stinking taverns and started fights because somebody was looking at me. I'd say, what are you looking at? Go kick his chair out and get beat up again. What are you looking at? See, because shame is in the face and it's in the eyes. It's like you hide your face. You hide your face when somebody overlooks you. That is, they look at you too much. You don't have any privacy. You don't have any privacy. You don't have a room. You don't have a place where you can lock the door. You go to the bathroom, they come in the bathroom. They go to the bathroom in front of you. You're taking a bath, they come in the bathtub. They watch you. You don't have any privacy. See, children need privacy. We all need privacy. We need space. We need solitude. We're going to talk about how do we develop that so that we can develop this sense of privacy and modesty. And that I have a place where I can get away from your faces. You know what, in my life, and it's still that way a little bit, I love just to get all alone and lock the door. It's like, whew. See, because my boundaries have been so violated, I'm like raw nerves a lot of the time. If I'm in the presence of somebody, my caretaker stuff comes on. You know, I got to take care of your feelings. I got to take care of your needs. I got to be nice. Because that's the way I learned to be loved. Be nice. I got to pay attention to you. And so when I get alone, it's like, now I don't want to be alone. I want to know a bunch of people love me, but I like to physically be alone. I don't know if you can identify with that. But I was overseen as a child. And as soon as I got out of my parents' sights, they said, God is watching you. And He knows every thought you're thinking. You can never escape. So, oh my God, just when I thought I was in the room alone, God's watching me. Whew. You can't ever, there's no exit. John Paul Sartre's right, there's no exit. You can't get out of here. without somebody. And what are they doing? They're examining and measuring you and seeing if you measure up. Have you been a good boy or a bad boy? A good girl. See, you have that sense of badness from the earliest age. I don't care how healthy you get, there's always that deep little post-hypnotic trance voice of badness. Because we were watched and measured with good and bad by well-meaning people. These weren't bad people. They had the same thing happen to them. And we do what happened to us. Alice Miller talks about this story of these 100 kids and their mothers, and they're going up to see Santa Claus, and all the mothers have told Santa Claus one bad thing that they've done. So little Johnny comes up and says, "Hi, Santa." And Santa says, "What do you want for Christmas?" "Well, I want a little bicycle." And Santa says, "What about wetting the bed, Johnny?" And Alice Miller's point is that she looks over at all these mothers and they're smiling. Isn't this cute? See, and here's this kid standing up, being publicly shamed, getting an inherent deep sense of badness. And they're grinning, not because they're bad mothers, because this stuff is multi-generational. And you can't know the truth of childhood till you get out of it. So when I am shamed from an early age, I'm either going to give in to that and just be totally limited, so I'll be a slob, I'll be an F, I'll fail, I don't care, so I'll be shameful, or I'll go to the other polarity and I'll be perfect, righteous, judgmental, blaming everyone else, and I'll be more than human. See, or I will be more than human for 6 months, and then I'll eat some pecan pie one night, and then I go over here and be a slob for several months. But I'm never in the middle in that good balanced polarity. I'm always all or nothing. See, I was drinking, and I was this extraordinary guy, and then I'd be in a hangover, and I'd be a worm. And what I really am is an extraordinary worm. So, let's take a break.